Good afternoon, everyone. We'll call the meeting of Climate and Energy to order. And for the record, we do have a quorum. Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the meeting minutes from March 21st?
I have, Madam Chair, and I would move approval.
Wonderful. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We have Representative Hansen here today to present House File 2502. And so since she's not in our committee, I will go ahead and move that House File 2502 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I see there is a DE1. So I'll go ahead and move the DE1 and get the bill in the shape that the author would like, consider it. Any discussion? Let's see. So, yes, I move the DE1. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So welcome, Representative Hansen. Go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. It's an honor to be before this committee for my first time, and I'm so sorry I didn't bring the snacks. I know that's the rule, but we ran short on time today, so I owe you. This bill is a program for electric school buses that builds on the success of the Solar for Schools program that demonstrated that there's a real local interest in using cleaner technologies in our kids' environments. An electric bus program that was funded by the Volkswagen settlement proved popular when in 2020, 8 electric school buses were awarded to 5 districts across the state. There's growing momentum to continue to invest in electric buses and to protect our kids from diesel fumes. Electric buses are no longer just a vehicle of the future. They're a growing part of bus fleets around the United States. As many of you may recognize, I don't do a lot of work in this committee's space. However, I serve on the Children and Families Committee and the Human Services Committees, where we hear every single meeting about the barriers to health and wellness that kids around Minnesota face on a regular basis. I've talked on the House floor about the importance of doing all we can to protect and provide for our kids. But the work doesn't just stop at improving things in those DHS-related arenas. We have to do more, and that means that we need to take action on initiatives like this. And that's why I agreed to work on this with the fabulous community members who are here with me today, and I know a bunch are watching online as well. Diesel buses expose children to dangerous diesel fumes. Studies have shown that students who were exposed to lower diesel bus emissions had 8% fewer absent school days, better lung function testing, and improved academic test scores. As much as the mom in me wants to dive into the importance of protecting our kids' lungs and health, I won't go into too much detail since my testifier will, and I'm going to stay in my lane and just go over the details of the bill. This bill does 5 things to accomplish the goal of reducing the number of buses that expose our children to harmful diesel fuels. First, it creates a grant program at the Department of Commerce with general fund money. The utility funds may also be made available by PUC-approved cost recoveries. Second, it allows the Department of Commerce to award grants to school districts, student transportation service providers, electric vehicle service providers, or utilities that want to install or operate electric buses and electric vehicle infrastructure to serve a school district. Third, the awards are prioritized for districts with higher rates of student poverty, rural districts, and districts funded by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Fourth, it supports districts who are eligible to receive grants to cover 75 to 95% of the cost of replacing or repowering buses that use fossil fuels. And lastly, districts can apply to participate in 2 grant cycles per year. The Department of Commerce would administer this process and provide technical assistance throughout. Minnesota is the North Star state. It's in our nature to lead. This bill does just that. In 2022, $1 billion of the IIJA funds were awarded nationally as a part of the Clean School Bus Program. Minnesota only received $1.6 million to purchase 4 electric buses, while Wisconsin received $25 million for 65 buses, and Michigan got $54 million for 138 buses. You'll see in the handout with the pictures on it some of the differences for other states. We can do better for Minnesota kids, and this bill is a step towards just that. So thank you for your time today, committee members and chair, and with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Thank Representative, and Dr. Dan Trajano is with us. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chair Akam and committee members. I'm Daniel Trajano, Dr. Daniel Trajano from Savage, Minnesota. I am a retired family physician and a University of Minnesota and University of St. Thomas professor. I volunteer on health and environmental advocacy with MN350, Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate, and the 100% campaign. As a physician and a teacher, I am proud of Minnesota's rich history of excellence in education and health. However, we are way behind other states when it comes to pursuing school transportation that will significantly improve children's health and academics. And I urge you to pass House File 2502 to improve children's health and education by accelerating Minnesota's transition to zero-emission electric school buses. Every day, every school day, hundreds of thousands of Minnesota K-12 students are exposed to harmful diesel emissions to and from schools. The health impact from these emissions also harms drivers and school employees. It is even worse for students of color and low-income students who are already disproportionately exposed to high levels of air pollution. For example, data has shown that kids living in North Minneapolis and the Phillips neighborhoods, predominantly BIPOC communities, experience asthma hospitalizations at five times the rate as Minnesotans across the state. Asthma-inducing particulate matter levels are up to 15 times higher inside the cab of a diesel school bus. There have been large-scale randomized trials that have shown that students who are exposed to lower diesel emissions have fewer absent school days, better lung function, and better test scores. And diesel particulate matter increases the risk of numerous other health conditions, including asthma, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and birth anomalies. And converting all of the U.S. school bus fleet to zero-emission buses will eliminate over 5 million tons of harmful carbon emissions. Several states have recently passed electric school bus legislation, including New York, which is committed to achieving a fully zero-emission school bus fleet by 2035. And they passed an additional $500 million of state funding for electric school buses. Colorado passed funding for an additional $65 million in initial funding for grant program and a technical assistance program for schools. And Governor Whitmore in Michigan just recently announced that she is planning to include $150 million in electric school bus funding in her 2023 budget. So for the sake of Minnesota children's health and education, I urge legislators to pass Representative Hansen's electric school bus bill, HF 2502. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Trajano. Next, we have Brooke Roper. Hello. And Brooke has a companion here.
Yes. Sorry.
Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
All right. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Hi.
Introduce your friend, too.
Yes, so I'm Brooke Roper, and this is my son, Corey CJ. It is my pleasure to be here today to provide this important testimony to the committee and want to thank you for this opportunity. Again, my name is Brooke Roper. I'm the parent of Corey CJ and Brooklyn Roper and a supporter of MN350. During the winter of 2022, my husband and I experienced paralyzing fear when our 4-year-old son, CJ, suddenly experienced difficulty breathing. He was immediately taken to Children's Hospital emergency room, where doctors believed it was reaction to the sick bug that was going around. Afterward, we took CJ home and monitored his breathing extremely closely. Several months later, CJ experienced a similar breathing episode, and doctors began to suspect asthma. In the end, CJ was officially diagnosed with asthma after several more doctor visits and incidents. As a mother and asthma survivor, I am committed to ensuring that my son's asthma remains well controlled and managed responsibly. Although CJ does not ride the bus consistently, he has ridden the bus for field trips and activities, and I immediately noticed a difference in his breathing when he inhaled the heavy fumes from the bus. As CJ is eager to ride the bus with his friends, my husband Corey and I are very hesitant about putting him on the school bus as his primary mode of transportation for the next school year. We have a shared responsibility of ensuring that our students have the chance to breathe clean air. Diesel has a huge impact on existing health conditions such as asthma, and Minnesota's K-12 student population is exposed daily to harmful diesel emissions to and from school. These emissions also harm drivers and school employees. It is even worse for students of marginalized communities who are already disproportionately exposed to high levels of air pollution. According to recent national data from the American Lung Association, black people are 42% more likely than whites to have asthma and a mortality rate of from asthma 2.8 times that of white people. Electrifying school buses will help reduce this disparity. In Minnesota, zip codes with the largest percentage of minority residents had more than five times the rate of asthma emergency room visits related to air pollution compared to areas with more white residents, according to the 2022 Life and Breath Report from the, by the Minnesota Department of Health and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. If Minnesota is committed to ensuring it is the best day for our kids, it is time to prioritize electrifying our school bus fleet and safeguarding clean air for our children and communities. Along with free meals, let's please prioritize air free of harmful toxins for our children and school employees by supporting SF2993. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Roper, and thanks, CJ. And we have one additional testifier, Paula Thompson. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I'm Dr. Paula Thompson. I am a retired physician from Savage, Minnesota, and mother of two, and a volunteer with MN350 South Metro. I just want to urge you all to take advantage of the money-saving opportunities that electric school buses represent. It is estimated that each electric school bus will save a school district upwards of $4,000 per year per school bus. This is fuel and maintenance savings, but we've heard quotes up to $11,000 per year. This could be a very significant money savings for school districts, especially when the federal funding right now, that we kind of missed out on this last year, this year there will also be $1 billion of that funding available. And schools can apply for up to 25 electric school buses at a time. And depending on the school district, they might be able to get every single school bus paid for with the federal government money and the charging structure paid for. When what we've noticed in our school districts, because we went and spoke repeatedly to school districts down in the South Metro, is they don't seem to, number one, understand that this is already taking place and that there are school districts all over, including in Minnesota, you know, eight school buses running. We had the first electric school bus in Minnesota in Lakeville in 2017, so we started off with a bang. It's been running. I believe State Senator Port's child rides that school bus. And so it works. It saves money. If you do the math, it could save a school district $100,000 a year if they happen to be able to get the 25 school buses. It also makes me want to imagine that if we distributed these buses widely and equitably throughout the state, the financial benefits could be part of an increasing and lasting financial stability for Minnesota schools, something especially needed in rural communities, tribal communities, and poor communities in the state, and those communities are prioritized in this bill. On the other hand, you could imagine a Minnesota in the future with increasing cost burdens because we continued to rely on burning fossil fuels to transport our students. We have over 13,000 buses in the state currently. Only about 12 of them are electric. Transitioning off of these diesel buses will go a long way to meeting our greenhouse goals. And I just feel it's time for Minnesota to accelerate this electrification of our school bus fleets, help schools take advantage of the financial savings that they will produce in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson. And so we've got a few minutes for questions. Representative Slozinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just double checking, do we have a cost on the bill for what you're planning on? How much does a bus cost?
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. With the DE amendment, we don't have a fiscal note on the DE yet, so we'll need to wait for that, and I would anticipate before choosing to include this in your omnibus bill, it would be fiscally responsible to get that note beforehand, but with the DE coming down pretty recently to get the bill in the shape that we wanted, we're still waiting on that.
And did you have a cost for one bus? Do we know what a bus costs?
Yes, yeah, my testifiers know. I'm sorry, Chair. My testifiers do know that right off the top of their heads.
So. Dr. Yes,
sir. The cost of an electric school bus, depending on the size, can be upwards to $350,000 to $400,000. Diesel bus, $100,000, $150,000. However, the total lifetime ownership gets close to parity when you consider what Dr. Thompson was saying, with the cost savings of fueling and maintenance of a electric bus compared to a diesel bus, $4,000 to $11,000 per year in savings. Over a 13-year lifespan of an average bus, it gets close to parity. And if you actually get the federal funds from the IIJA or a school gets funding through another means like a state-funded program, grant program, you will actually reap those savings because of the differential in cost savings with maintenance and fueling.
Next on the list, we have Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Akam. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill. I think you know how much I love electric school buses. There was a couple of things I wanted to add that I think are really important when we consider this. So in addition to upper respiratory issues, diesel fumes are known carcinogens and lead to bladder and lung cancer. And that's stuff that we're exposing our kids to and drivers to every single day, as well as bystanders just in our communities where buses are sitting and idling. And so realistically, we are ending up paying for what happens to those individuals, especially when we talk about low-income areas where people have a tendency to go to emergency services as opposed to having regular checkups. And those costs get passed along to us, right? Like the community ends up paying for this. So just from a purely fiscal standpoint, I think there's a really good argument to be made for electrifying our school bus system. The other thing I wanted to point out is I think that there is an opportunity for us to look at Minnesota as figuring out how we can be electric school bus manufacturers. I know that we do have a manufacturing facility for electric buses, but I know that school buses have a much higher standard than our regular transportation buses, and I think that that's something that I would really love to have us explore in the area of economic development because this is coming, and this could be a real moneymaker for the state of Minnesota. So thank you so much for bringing this. I appreciate your testifiers. I inherited this bill last biennium from Zach Stevenson, and, I really want to see this get some money this time. So thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next on the list is Representative Garofalo. And just to let people know, we've got four more, including Representative Garofalo, so we can be kind of quick. And five.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As an electric vehicle owner for the last 9 years, I am aware of the benefits as well as the liabilities of being an electric vehicle owner. So for either the author or the testifiers, based on your knowledge, what do you believe the range of an electric bus is right now?
Dr. Trujano or Dr.
Yeah, I can speak to that. I've been attending the EPA Region 5 webinars pretty regularly. Michigan has actually the most experience with electric buses over the past several years. And we have also spoken with local transportation directors and bus drivers. I believe the range currently is around 130 miles. Average bus routes are far less than that. So in the transportation directors and drivers we spoke with, They are not having any trouble at all covering the range in terms of the average routes of their buses.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either again the author or the testifiers. How much if we assume the 130 miles number, which we'll just assume that number for the sake of argument, how much range is diminished when say Minnesota is below zero? How much of that range is lost?
Dr. Trujano.
There are certainly loss in range in cold weather. The best answer I got was from Chaska School Districts, where they have a Bluebird electric bus. Their bus actually has an auxiliary diesel heater. The heating of the bus does consume a lot of energy. But he actually measures the amount of diesel fuel used in terms of pints instead of gallons. So that can help offset that. Preheating the bus actually helps. I believe he said somewhere, and this is our experience too with electric cars, somewhere around 20% reduction in range in the wintertime. They actually, and it is true, there is a reduction, and if you're going a longer route, they actually said they kept it in the garage, twice in the first year of use because of fear of range. But every other school day they used it.
So, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, to stay warm on the buses, do they use the diesel heaters, propane heaters, or do they use electric heat when the kids are on it?
Dr. Trujano.
It varies between the bus type. And like I said, the Bluebird bus that they were using used a diesel heater. I think others I believe, do use propane heaters. Others use the pure electric heat, which, you know, if it's a cold winter, I'm sure that does decrease the range. But again, the range of the buses are in the currently, and this is current technology, and I'm sure they will increase over time, is 130 miles, which far exceeds the range of a normal bus route on average.
You can't. Oh. Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm doing you a favor there. So,
Madam Chair, and
Garofalo, would you like a final question?
Yes. So, and maybe this would be for the author of the bill. Assuming that somebody wants a bus to be electrified as the best way to reduce pollution, assuming that we're not one of the coldest states in the country, assuming that we're not using diesel to keep kids or to keep people on the bus warm. Now, we're in school 8.5, to 9 months out of the year, 5 days a week. We have a transit system that runs essentially 365 days out of the year. If we're going to be making these sorts of spending on electric buses, wouldn't it make sense to invest in buses that are running 12 months out of the year as opposed to just part of the year?
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair. I think the question is, should kids go to school 12 months a year? Is that what you're asking, Representative Garofalo?
No, Madam Chair. What I'm saying is that if we're going to be spending this sort of money on buses, does it make sense to have to invest in them in a way where in the months of June, July, and August they're sitting idle versus if we were to buy buses for Metro Transit and they would work 12 months out of the year? That way, whatever savings, whatever environmental benefits you're achieving, you're getting it for 100% of the year as opposed to 75% of the year.
Well, and I think I will just maybe say, I think one of the benefits of electric buses when they're not being used, that they can be used as energy storage, and then that storage can be deployed during times of peak use. So I think utilities are actually interested in looking at electric buses for that particular reason.
I think the biggest advantage of using school buses is actually their intermittent use. And, charging a vehicle overnight is the most energy efficient, lowest cost, and most environmentally friendly way to charge. And if they charge a vehicle, like an electric school bus overnight, and use it for a limited purpose of, 60, 80, 100 miles, and then charge that again overnight, that is the most energy efficient and most environmentally friendly way to charge. In addition to what Chair Aikman is saying, there are trials now of actually using vehicle-to-grid technology to use those school buses as storage. And think of a summer hot day when school's not in session. You can actually use those bus batteries as sort of peaker plants, non-fossil fuel peaker plants. And that's that is why utilities are interested in partnering with schools on these buses.
Thank you, Doctor. And let's see, we've got still five people on the list, so I'm going to ask that people can be quick, brief, and just ask one question. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for the bill author, and it's about, so subsection 2 on page 3 goes from 3.2 to 3.6, and then page 5, 5.5 to 5.7. It's talking a lot about encouraging schools to use vehicle electrification as a teaching tool. Can you just kind of give me a rundown of what your vision was for that, what it will kind of be doing?
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Igo. I think as we, raise kids in this world, it's important that we help them understand what that technology of the future looks like. We've talked a lot in the education spaces about doing, continuing education or any kind of service learning and service in the trades. And so exposing kids to understanding what these vehicles do and how it affects their health, I think, is important. But I would also defer to my testifier, who's working hands-on with a lot of communities, to give you a more in-depth answer as well, if that's okay.
Briefly, Dr. Trujano.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of specifics on how specific schools are using that, but that is one of the things that Michigan schools were saying. We use these in classroom education on how they run, and I don't have a specific curriculum for that, though.
Representative Hornstein?
Oh. Can I please, Madam Chair?
Briefly, Representative Igo.
Thank you. The point I was making and all that is, obviously, we don't have a supply chain for how we make these buses. It's coming from around the world, places that don't have environmental standards, labor standards. I think if we want to raise our children into a new economy that is aware of its surroundings and understands what happens when you flip a light switch on or you plug a bus in, we should know that we should be making it here and not being reliant around the world. Because otherwise, we're just going to destroy the world around us, say we have electric buses here. We can start teaching our kids about how important mining is in industry and manufacturing, and I would love to see that be a part of the bill today.
Representative Hornstein.
Just real quick, Madam Chair, thank you. It's more of a comment, no question. Big thanks to Representative Hansen for bringing this bill, and I, Representative Holland had made a point I wanted to make about cost and health, and it was a point that was made a lot by the previous, the first chair, I think, of this committee when it was called Climate and Energy, Representative Wagenius. And Representative Wagenius was also, I think, one of the first authors of this bill as well. So there's a whole chain of wonderful authors and chairs that have brought this forward, and so I'm channeling Representative Wagenius, and thank you so much again for bringing this bill and for hearing it, Madam Chair.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing this. Love this bill. Really going to say pretty much the same thing as Representative Hornstein. While I actually appreciate the emissions reductions in this, the side benefits are almost the main reasons to doing this. For the health of our kids, we have a technology that can work, and on the long term is close to a parity, and I think our kids, the investment is worth it. Thank you.
And final question, Representative Davis.
Well, I have a question and a comment. I rarely speak in this committee, so I wish I had some more time. Representative Groffel actually asked a lot of my questions. Mm-hmm. And so I would just like to say, I think the point that Representative Groffel was making, Madam Chair, was wouldn't it make more sense to invest in the Metro Transit, switching that to electric, as opposed to school buses? If you're trying to remove emissions out of the air, that would be a much more efficient way to go as far as that. I know of a school district that's already doing this, though. Crosby Ironton School District in my district that I serve, they have 18 buses, school buses, and 12 of them are powered by propane. And what they find is that these buses start and over 40 below, they're incredibly reliable. They have 67% savings on fuel, and they're not putting harmful toxins into the environment, and incredibly reliable. They have 250,000 miles on one of their buses that they first purchased 10 years ago, and it's still running. Have we thought about that, switching to propane buses?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative. I think that's an idea that folks should explore. This program is definitely not mandatory for districts like yours who would like to continue to explore that sort of technology. We have just heard from a lot of districts who would like to explore this, and this is the path that we're going. But I think if you found a program that people would like to invest in, that sounds like a great bill idea to continue to reduce the diesel fumes that our kids are being exposed to, because that's the bigger goal. And again, if they start in 40 below, I mean, I'm a Minnesotan through and through, and I don't start in 40 below. So,
and I think I will just make a quick comment about the transit buses versus school buses. I think transit buses drive a lot longer routes, and so the range is actually more of a challenge because of that. But that's closing comments, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you again, committee members. I really appreciate the discussion. I just want to say I encourage you to support this program. Feel free to reach out to me if there's any other questions. I know this came up kind of briefly, and we've only had a brief time to talk about it. But as we look at the future of what our kids need, as we look at making sure that Minnesota is the best place to live, work, and raise a family, and that we give all kids in Minnesota a great start, this is one of the ways we can do that. We cannot throw children under the bus as we fight for climate change. So thank you again for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And with that, the bill is laid over. Next bill on our agenda today is House File 2747, Representative Ream, who is making her way to the table. And as she's getting settled, Representative Ream moves House File 2747 be laid over for possible inclusion. And it looks as though there's a DE2. So, Representative Ream, would you like to move the DE2?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Ream moves DE2 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Go ahead and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, HF 2747. Makes adjustments to the existing solar for schools programs. And as a reminder, there are two programs right now under the Solar for Schools umbrella. We have, on one side, we have the program funded by the general fund and administered by the Department of Commerce for schools located outside of Xcel Energy territory. And we also have a program funded by the Renewable Development Account administered by Xcel Energy for schools located within the Xcel Energy territory. And this bill moves the Solar for Schools program, currently under the jurisdiction of Xcel Energy, to the Department of Commerce to streamline the administration of the program through one entity. The Commerce Run program has been popular and hugely successful. I know I talked to a representative about this, and they told me that their district had really wanted to be part of it, but there wasn't enough money. So with this bill, we'll be able to help those districts who want to be part of the program but aren't able to right now. The demand for the Solar for School grants has already exceeded the funds available. And in terms of history, the Minnesota Department of Commerce received 122 applications totaling $11.8 million in grant requests, $4.6 million over the $7.2 million initial program budget. In the first round of funding, Solar for Schools is on track to award about $7.5 million in grants for up to 80 schools in 45 school districts across the state. Per the statute, grants are awarded based on the financial need of the school, with projects receiving between 25 to 95% of the total project cost to install solar panels on school rooftops or school grounds. And with that, I think I might want to move to our first testifier, who can maybe explain in greater detail how this works.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Solem. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Yeah, Chair Aiken, members of the committee. My name is Braden Solem. I'm the Vice President of Business Development at Ideal Energies. We're a commercial solar company here in Minneapolis that focuses on developing projects for Minnesota's public sector. We do private sector work too, but specifically a lot of public sector work. In that public sector, we work closely with many school districts, cities, counties, and government entities to develop on-site rooftop solar projects on public buildings that directly offset utility expenses. And thank you for allowing me time to speak in support of House File 2747 today. As I said, our company specializes in installing solar arrays on public buildings, but specifically within the public sector, we have extensive experience installing solar on Minnesota school buildings. To date, we've completed or are currently installing over 150 solar installations on Minnesota schools spread across over 40 districts. The vast majority of these projects have historically been installed within public utilities, so Minnesota Power Territory, Xcel Energy Territory, that have offered either incentive programs or have a compensation method for the benefits that the solar array brings to the grid. And so for schools outside of Xcel, the Solar for Schools program has opened the door for these schools to install arrays that save them hundreds of thousands of dollars over the life of each system installed. The Solar for Schools program for utilities located outside of Xcel territory completed its first round in 2022. And as we just heard, the program was completely oversubscribed, and there was such significant interest in the program that the Department of Commerce had to limit applications to two projects per district in some cases. Similar to many public entities located outside of Xcel territory, there has been little to no opportunity to install these commercial size arrays due to the lack of incentive programs that I was just talking about. That stimulate these installations by reducing the upfront cost of the projects. So for many, the Solar for Schools program has been the first time that they've been able to explore on-site solar for their school buildings. And from our experience working with districts so far, we found that many have been waiting for this opportunity and are very excited to participate. And it's safe to assume that this demand will grow as more and more districts participate over time. So ultimately, we anticipate there is more than enough demand for this program to utilize all the potential funding outlined in this bill. What I found most interesting about participating in this program with districts has been the outpouring of support some of these projects have received from their administration, school boards, and in many cases, their utilities. For many of the utilities, these projects are the first commercial-sized solar arrays installed in their territory, and they've been very supportive and have actively collaborated with us in the districts to help submit applications as well as providing ongoing support to the schools by even offering to participate in the educational component that the program requires. The educational component of the program is also very unique and has led to some fascinating conversations with districts about how to tailor solar curriculum assets to their classroom needs. Each participating district sees these projects as an important hands-on learning tool that they are eager to implement to their curriculum. We have worked with professional educators to develop educational modules that focus on vocational opportunities in the clean energy industry. We've received great feedback from the schools about this requirement, and they're eager to implement the tools provided by both our company and then some of the offerings provided by clean energy resource teams who's contracted with the Department of Commerce. Finally, I'd like to point out that like all new programs, there have been some growing pains in areas that can be improved to make the program run more efficiently in both the outside Xcel and within Xcel Energy Territory programs. And the solar industry, with the help of the Department of Commerce and with feedback from schools, have worked collaboratively to propose some changes that are included in today's amendment that help to make this high-demand program more successful for projects within and outside Xcel territory. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Solem. Next on the list, we have Sarah Wolf with Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. Welcome back to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Wolf. I'm with Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. And hello, Representative Bream. Thank you to all of the testifiers today on all the great bills. And I want to thank this committee for the opportunity to share thoughts about House File 2747. We appreciate this committee's deep work and commitment to moving to our clean energy future and that you see schools as having a significant impact on bringing that future forward. MNIPL has a vision of schools serving as hubs of resilience for communities across the state where they have solar and storage that the school owns, saving that school money that they can use towards other purposes, and then allowing it to serve the community as a functioning resource, even if power has been disrupted elsewhere. We applaud this DE amendment that asks the Department of Commerce to run the program for the whole state. And as we work to equitably meet the carbon reduction deadlines science demands, we have three concerns. First, the appropriation and grant structure of this program as it is to not help us achieve meaningful scale is if our goal is to help all schools benefit from solar. We hope you might revise this program to consider taking advantage of different financing models, such as grants combined with loans, low interest loans, that can help this investment go further. Second, we are concerned about an inequity in the benefit to schools within and outside of the Xcel territory, and that disparity is further baked into this program. Schools within the Xcel territory are eligible for a 1,000 kilowatt array, while schools outside of the Xcel territory, most often schools in greater Minnesota, are limited to a 40 kilowatt array. A 40 kilowatt array would power about 5 average sized homes, and in many cases, that's only about 5 to 10% of the power used by a school. This severely limits the savings available to those schools and does not allow them to serve as stable, resilient resources for the community. The result of this disparity, schools within Xcel and schools outside of Xcel, means that those schools outside of Xcel are able to save only about 4%, see about only 4% of the savings that schools within Xcel territory are able to feel the financial benefit of. Finally, we understand that interconnection is a significant issue. Just as we were hearing in this committee yesterday, we think there is an opportunity to help rural electric co-ops and municipal utilities fund interconnection grid improvements that will serve not only the school, but the surrounding community. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for this committee's excellent work.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Next on the list, we have Jenna Warma from Vote Solar. Maybe she wasn't able to make it. So with that, we'll bring it back to the committee. Any questions or comments by members? Representative Swazinski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in general, would you consider the schools to be have the ability to go off-grid after these are installed?
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, ideally, I think that would be great. I don't really know. I don't know if there's someone that I could phone a friend here. I believe
Mr. yes. Solem, right. I can maybe offer a perspective.
Yeah, Representative. So these solar arrays, it really just depends on the size of the school, but currently the way our company installs is these are what are called just behind the meter grid interconnected solar arrays. And the way it works is that the solar array has the ability to export energy to the grid if the building is, if it's ever producing more than the building is consuming. And so the inverters have something called anti-islanding technology. And so if the grid goes down, the inverters turn off because they don't want energy being pumped onto the grid while the line workers are working on it. So the way that we install these systems is they're currently not the capability to take a school entirely off grid. But that being said, in the future, adding batteries to a solar array or expanding a solar array to be able to have that capability is potentially there.
Any follow-up, Representative Swazinski? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Solem, first of all, let me congratulate you on having a fantastic business model for what you're doing by having a center, centering your industry around the public sector. That is, I wish I would have thought about that 5 or 10 years ago. That is a compliment, not as an insult. In terms of standard solar array installations for schools, what would be the approximate size of it? Would you say, like, I understand there's deviations, but just on average?
It depends on the territory that we're in. So there are net metering rules that are different for public utilities versus cooperative utilities. So in cooperative and municipal utilities, it's typically a 40 kilowatt AC, and then we'll oversize the DC to about 59.4 kW DC. Now, in XL territory, where we do a lot larger solar arrays, I'd say the average is around 350 kW. And some perspective on usage in a school is there's typically enough real estate on the rooftop to offset around 30 to 40% of a school's total energy consumption with larger arrays.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, if I could just, I don't expect you to have these numbers memorized, but I think it would be helpful for the committee to understand if perhaps you could email the chair and she could share this with staff, but if you could show members, for a 40 kilowatt installation, here's an approximate cost, incentive, the average energy output, and the capacity factor. Those three things for a 40 kilowatt array and a 300 kilowatt array, just so members understand the cost and the amount of electricity, unless you want to seriously impress me and tell me that you have those numbers memorized right now.
I can answer for a 40 kilowatt system, I could give you that. So I know that this question was actually asked when we were here testifying about the solar and public buildings program. So we worked with Mincia to kind of pull members to kind of get some pricing. I know, like, if you're looking at a 40 kilowatt DC array, it's a 1-to-1 ratio with an inverter, that would probably be in the realm of around $140,000. That can scale up to closer to around like 175 if you're looking at like a 60 kW array, and that can go down, as far as to zero, as long as its systems just get smaller. For that array, that would produce around 75,000 kilowatt hours a year, I think, off the top of my head. Typically what we do for math is 1,125 kilowatt hours per kilowatt installed DC. So that's just a ratio you can use to calculate energy. And a capacity factor for a solar array is around about 15.9%, 16%.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, and the testifier gets an A for the day. Those numbers check out. So, thank you very much. I appreciate it. So I think it's when we're talking about 75,000 kilowatt hours, the numbers you're providing, the 140 to 175,000, I'm assuming that's pre-incentive, correct?
That would be like the cost of installing an array.
So pre-installation, pre-install tax credit.
Yes.
Pre-tax rewards and programs, and the value of that energy in terms of. If we were to compare it to the price of electricity, we're looking at about $1,500 a year if I ratchet it up.
No, it really depends on the amount that the school pays. So, up in Minnesota Power territory, schools are paying 13 cents a kilowatt hour. So you'd multiply that by your 75,000 kilowatt hours, and that's your value of that energy. And you get down in the southern part of the state and schools are paying 6-7 cents because there's a lot of wind. So it really depends school to school. So I can't give you an exact answer on that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the answers from the testifier.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who owns the RECs after these are built? Do the school districts or do you?
Representative, for the program that is outside of XL territory, the school claims ownership of all the recs. Within XL territory, the way that it's the bill is currently written, they own the renewable energy credits for the lifetime of the array. XL does.
Any other questions or comments from members? Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Ream?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the discussion here. Thank you for the testimonies. I want to give a shout out to former Representative Gene Wagenius, who brought this forward. And I know a lot of the work we do is work that's been in process for years. So shout out to her and to Chair Acomb, who also carried the bill. You know, this project, I think it's, in my opinion, it's a very bipartisan project. You know, I've got a lot of neighbors who are putting solar panels up. I think they're doing it because they save money. This is how we can save money. So our schools will be saving money with this. And I think that's, you know, a big win. Another important part of this program is that students are learning. You know, they're learning as they're in these schools, you know, how solar energy works. They're able to see it. They're able to benefit from it. And they can bring that learning back to their families and teach their grandparents and parents about it. So I think that's another win. And then finally, you know, we're a state that is completely 100% dependent on fossil fuels. So for us to be independent by having our own source of energy, I think, is another huge win. So win, 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 as we like to say. Thank you very much.
That seems to be a phrase you have coined the last couple of days. So with that, House file, let's see where we are, 2747 is laid over. And I'm now going to go switch and present a bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Everything's upside down. Yeah. I'll have to look that
up. Okay. All right. As the chair gets set, I will move that House File 1853 be laid over for possible conclusion. Chair Acomb, to your help.
Thank you. Chair Kraft, let's see. I'm sort of organized here. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm presenting House File 1853, which develops a weather-ready extension program. This bill is building capacity within the existing structure of our successful and trusted extension program to assist land managers across the state to be more resilient in their land practices and to adapt to their our changing climate. Extension Services has a long tradition of taking science-based solutions and working with counties, tribal governments, and private landowners to build a better Minnesota, which is exactly what we need to be doing at this moment in time when we are facing challenges caused by our changing climate. So we do have an amendment in the packet. We didn't get it in time to make it, so we'll add it for the omnibus. But I just maybe want to mention the amendment before I turn it over to our testifier. And so it's reducing the cost of the bill to just the annual programmatic costs of $1 million. And the additional funding is going to be allocated with the Department of Pollution Control. So PCA has a program and sees this as an opportunity to partner and make it a win-win-win. Following in Lucy's footsteps here. But so that'll be put in as part of the omnibus, but I just offer that as to explain why it's there. But with that, maybe I can turn it over to my testifier, or our testifier, Dr. Heidi Roop with the University of Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership.
Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Dr. Heidi Roop. Chair Kraft, members of the committee, nice to see you. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to you about extension and our hopes for the future of how we can better serve the state of Minnesota.
I'm an assistant professor of climate science and the state's sole extension specialist for climate change and adaptation at the University of Minnesota. As part of my role in extension, I get to the great privilege of leading a team called the Climate Adaptation Partnership, where we work to advance critical climate science and other knowledge about how our state is changing. But as our name implies, we work in direct partnership with communities, commodity groups, and across the public and private sectors to support the use, integration, and education required to bring climate-related knowledge and solutions into decision-making, all with the goal of improving the health and well-being of Minnesota residents, our waterways, and our natural and built environments. We know that Minnesota is getting warmer and wetter and already grappling with the impacts and consequences of this warmth, as well as the challenges associated with coping with the more frequent transitions we're experiencing between flood and drought conditions. And just as the science says it's critical that we seek pathways to reduce emissions, the science shows it's also urgent we work together to prepare our communities and economies for the impacts of climate change that we know we've already set in motion and that we've committed to. However, to date, our programs and our investments seeking to build preparedness for both weather and longer-term climate risks tend to be fragmented, small in scale, sector-specific, and often designed to respond to the near-term risks, reaction, rather than a proactive approach. We're also focused more on planning than implementation. And right now, with historic federal investments passed through the Infrastructure Investments and Job Acts and the Inflation Reduction Act, Minnesota could be well poised to benefit from a multitude of mitigation and adaptation investments. But surveys of our local units of government show very clearly that both lack of capacity and technical expertise are barriers to accessing competitive funds that would bring community-identified projects and priorities into reality. These are barriers that relatively small investments, like in this program, could help our state overcome, bringing significant rewards and offering substantial returns on investment. An extension is uniquely positioned to provide this needed trusted, durable, and localized capacity across the state, offering needed technical assistance that's not just centralized in one geography. Our mission is to discover science-based solutions, deliver practical education, and engage Minnesotans to build a better future. From urban and rural, city to township, Extension has a reach and impact in every county in Minnesota. We have a robust infrastructure, thanks in part to investments that already come in from the state of Minnesota, our counties, and the federal government. This includes our campuses, regional offices, and educators who provide programming across the state. You can see our regional offices denoted in yellow on the squares in this map. And our teams, importantly, live in and support the communities they serve. However, Extension's capacity and programming as it relates specifically to weather and climate preparedness is limited, as shown on the map in the maroon circles. I appreciate the map is really hard to see, so you can see it in your packet. We're currently falling short of our ability to meet all of the needs and requests for support coming from across the state. The Extension Weather Ready program seeks to address these needs by adding critical extension jobs and capacity across the state, bringing sector and place-specific knowledge to help communities that you serve better respond to their weather and climate risks. This capacity means we'll be better positioned to provide support to communities and sectors when they call, and we also will have needed people in the places where solutions and information are needed. This is both the power and the opportunity of Extension. Specifically, this program seeks to add capacity and expertise by placing critical Extension positions across the state. We see this program as a direct complement to the Extension program called the Clean Energy Resource Teams, or CERTs, which is supported by the state legislature. The Weather Ready Extension program would work as a direct complement to this energy efficiency and mitigation-focused program, bringing a holistic approach to climate challenges and the responses in the state of Minnesota. This investment would critically leverage Extension's existing infrastructure and our trusted partnerships. This is an opportunity to bring research into practice through dedicated Extension staff who are able to assist in the interpretation and application of localized climate data and research and other investments the state has made, including the state legislature. We seek to accelerate the timeline between planning and implementation by offering timely and accessible support that will make it easier for communities to apply for and secure state and federal grants, which are increasingly requiring a clear articulation of how future climate risks have been considered in any proposed project. This is a gap we can help fill. And we also know that one single solution won't work in all across our state and won't lead to the best outcomes for our diverse communities and industries. This program would facilitate defining and right-sizing evidence-based solutions for preparedness that work across our state. And overall, this program will fill a clear capacity gap that we hope Extension can continue to help fill and be a critical partner as we help communities identify how they can thrive and cope with the challenges of changing weather and climate extremes that many are already confronting and know are likely to worsen in the future. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and your hard work and many of the discussions you've all been having to think about how we can prepare our state not only for today, but also for tomorrow.
Public that wishes to testify? That I will open up to discussion, member questions. One.
Took the air right out of the room.
Chair Acom, would you have like the final words on the bill?
Sure. I would just like to point out that there are some letters of support that are in the packets, and it's a broad group of supporters, which I think is really important. I think that as we look to the work we need to do all across the state, the extension program is it makes sense to look to partner with them and the infrastructure that they have, as well as the expertise that they bring, and the science-based work coming from the University of Minnesota. So with that, I renew my motion that House File 1853 be laid over for possible inclusion.
So Representative Akin moves that House File 1853 be laid over for possible inclusion, and so be it.
The bill is laid over.
So with that, we have Representative Berg has not yet arrived here, I believe. So, Madam Chair, would you like to start, or should we recess? How would you like to do this?
Why don't I don't have the stuff.
Asking all the hard questions.
Yeah, you ask all the hard questions. why don't we take just a 5-minute recess? Should we do that? And hopefully she'll be here in short order. Should I just start with?
Just start.
There are testifiers, aren't there?
Yeah.
I got to grab the stuff. Okay, so we'll do that. Plan B.
Okay. Madam Chair, do you want to move this?
Sure. I will move that House File 2170 be laid over for possible inclusion.
I understand there's an author's amendment.
There's a DE, it looks like. And so I would like to move the DE, please.
So the chair would like to move that DE1 to get the bill in the shape that the author would like.
And, Mr. Chair, would the author like to explain the amendment in detail?
Representative Spinski, I'm noticing that I think the chair would not like to explain the amendment. So seeing no further discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Okay, with that, the amendment is adopted. So I think now you proceed if you want to just go straight to testimony.
Yeah, so maybe I'll just, House File 2170 established global warming impact standards required for construction materials used in state buildings and roads. Global warming standards integrated into procurement processes Pilot programs established to report greenhouse gas emissions for manufacturer of products, and grant programs established, technical advisory committee established, and reports required. So it's a great bill, and we're going to turn it over to Ms. Halverson to help us better understand.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Great. My name is Bree Halverson. I am the Midwest States Director for the Blue-Green Alliance, which is a coalition of unions and environmental associations started here in Minnesota. So I've been here before, and I think I'm going to stretch a little bit, and then hopefully we'll get to our good testifiers that know a little bit But essentially, we worked with a group of industry unions and environmental organizations to put together a bill to make sure that we are looking at embedded carbon in our construction materials. And in what the DE amendment, I can have the representative talk about it, if that is helpful.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Berg,
thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment significantly simplifies the bill in a way that makes it more practical to implement. It removes most of the prescriptive language that would describe in statute how this idea would work, and instead asks the task force that is created to come up with recommendations on how implementation should work. It ensures that relevant industry stakeholders are at the table helping to make these recommendations, makes implementation more flexible to avoid unanticipated consequences, and gives the impacted industries more of a voice in the direction of this effort. Everyone agrees that the industry is already heading this direction, and this amendment makes sure that the industries that will see the impacts help shape how we get there. Most importantly, this amendment helps us achieve the goals of creating good jobs here in Minnesota while reducing our impact on the environment over time by putting industry representatives, unions, and environmental organizations on a task force together to map out a path forward on implementation.
Thank you, Representative. So we've already adopted the amendment, so I'll turn it back over to your testifier, if that's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want me to make opening remarks, or were...
I thought those were just...
That was the walkthrough of the DE amendment.
I'm sorry. Please continue with your opening remarks.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Buy Clean is a pretty simple concept. I want to tell you, first of all, that this has been written up as the unicorn bill because it does actually have industry unions and the environmental groups all in agreement that this is a good thing. It says the products and materials that are used for public projects, like infrastructure improvements, should be the cleanest and most sustainable available. When we build a bridge or invest in a public building, Buy Clean will help ensure that taxpayer dollars are spent responsibly on materials including concrete, structural steel, and asphalt that are manufactured in a cleaner, more efficient, and environmentally friendly manner. This reduces climate pollution and negative health impacts while supporting good-paying jobs in Minnesota and our nation. House File 2170 begins a process to reduce the embedded carbon and environmental footprint in our construction materials in a phased, incremental manner. First, we create a task force led by the Department of Administration that includes stakeholders representing materials manufacturers, the construction industry, labor, environmental organizations, and state agencies. The task force will examine various construction materials, work with product manufacturers, begin to collect data, and start the process of creating environmental product declarations, or EPDs, for a variety of specific construction materials. Eventually, we will have a pilot project, and then down the line, we'll set maximum numeric values on a product-by-product basis that will be included in bid specifications included in state construction products. The task force and stakeholders throughout the industry will play a critical role in shaping how this rolls out. As you will hear, the industry is already moving in this direction. Manufacturers are beginning to create environmental product declarations already. The goal of this bill is to create a process to move this work forward in a coordinated way with all stakeholders involved. One other point that is important to make, America makes cleaner product than those that come from our foreign competitors. This bill is intended to make sure we're supporting Minnesota industries, especially companies in the cement, steel, and asphalt manufacturing. I am so happy to present a truly unique bill. I believe this is the only bill this session that has the support of both the 100% campaign and the Asphalt Paving Association. I think we're doing something right.
Thank you, Representative. So with that, shall I move it back to the testifier here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be great.
I think we have a few other testifiers on the list. So.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So first we have Travis Lohman. Please come on down and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Travis Lohman. I'm a District 11 staff representative for the United Steelworkers. District 11 represents workers in Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. I am here today to speak in favor of HF 2170, Representative Berg's Buy Clean Bill. Buy Clean is a policy that levels the playing field for companies that are doing things the right way. It also incentivizes those that aren't making the grade to get on board if they want to grow the opportunity for their businesses. Under this bill, makers of concrete, structural steel, and asphalt would be required to submit declarations that show how much climate pollution was generated making the products we use to repair and modernize Minnesota's infrastructure. This is important because many of these imported products and materials for our nation's infrastructure could be made by workers here in the United States instead of in countries with lower environmental and health standards and higher emitting facilities. Many manufacturers in Minnesota and the U.S. are cleaner than their global competitors. USW members are ready to supply the materials and products we need to fix Minnesota and our nation's infrastructure systems. Taxpayers deserve the most to get the most bang for their buck, both in terms of having the most climate-friendly products and ones that support good jobs here in the United States. The bottom line is that we make steel and other materials in the U.S. where we make them better, make it better and cleaner. We should reward workers and companies doing the things the right way by buying clean and buying fair when it comes to the materials we use to rebuild and modernize Minnesota's infrastructure. We should buy clean to support and grow good, family-sustaining union jobs. Thank you to Representative Berg and the co-sponsors of this bill for bringing it forward. The members of the United Steelworkers strongly support the effort to buy clean when it comes to our state's infrastructure, and we're ready to do the job. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Margaret Levin from Sierra Club. Would you come on down? Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Margaret Levin. I am the state director for the Sierra Club North Star chapter. The Sierra Club is the nation's oldest and largest grassroots environmental organization. We represent over 50,000 members and supporters across the state, and we thank you for the opportunity to share our support, and we thank Representative Berg and the co-authors for their work on this bill, the Buy Clean and Buy Fair Minnesota Act. State-level action is crucial to reducing carbon emissions and avoiding the worst effects of climate change. Of course, that's one of our top priorities. And we also know that along the way, we can build a strong clean energy economy, improve communities' health, and ensure good family-supporting jobs. Buildings are a major source of climate pollution, and the issue of emissions that are embodied throughout the life cycle of building materials has emerged as an important concern in recent years, with their manufacture accounting for 11% of total carbon emissions globally. So this bill takes an important step towards addressing this problem. The proposed pilot will explore a Minnesota-specific approach to reducing emissions in materials that we need to update our buildings and infrastructure. It will help to support manufacturers using cleaner and greener processes and techniques, and it will support a strong Minnesota workforce. So we're pleased to join labor, business, and other environmental organizations in supporting this bill, and we urge your support as well.
Thank you. Next, we have Abby Bryduck. Come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Abby Bryduck, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. I'm here to testify in support of Asphalt 2170. MAP is a trade association that represents asphalt pavers and producers in the state who pave roads from driveways to interstates. For several years now, our industry has discussed the eventual arrival of environmental product declarations and the move to green procurement. As you can imagine, companies are in varying stage of readiness for these changes. On the whole, the asphalt industry has evolved over the years to reduce its environmental footprint. We've done this by being the number one most recycled material in the nation, leading as the smoothest pavement option, resulting in better fuel efficiency for Minnesotans, improving production efficiencies at our plants by incorporating new technologies, and by leading the nation with long-lasting perpetual pavement roadways. Essentially, this bill creates a task force made up of stakeholders knowledgeable in their fields to work together to identify the various nuances between the industries involved and create processes based on informed decision-making and good science and engineering. The collaborative approach taken in this bill is critical to the success of our efforts. There's a dearth of data in this area, so a staggered and delayed implementation, pilot program, and a cooperative process between industry agencies and academics is the most reasonable way to approach our move to green procurement. States around the country are watching what we do here, as many of them are also looking to set up procurement processes that prioritize low carbon emissions. We'd like to thank the Blue-Green Alliance and Representative Berg for being open to our ideas in this bill. This language has been thoroughly vetted by the various stakeholder groups, and I believe we've come up with a good product. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. We don't have anyone else on the list. And Ms. Howison, did you want to come back and say anything? Okay. Anyone else want to? That will move to member questions and discussion. Representative Igoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, in kind of listening to that, I got my questions answered about the task force, so that's good to start. I just want to speak, Representative Berg, kind of been playing phone tag. We still need to sit down and talk about this. But this is, for the first part, I just want to speak especially to the steel part of this bill, which is a good thing. This is something that I've been talking about a while, about making sure that we are prioritizing not only Minnesota, but the United States. This is something that's directly going to help keep Chinese steel from getting dumped in the United States by prioritizing Minnesota. So this is a good thing. I would like to see the bill, as it shapes and forms, move to start talking about the other things, the copper, the nickel, and all the other components that we need for every daily life. This is a really good start, so I do want to speak to support of that. So this bill is a good start. I think it could go a little bit further. And my only question when it came to the task force was, it's great to see that we have a member of Minnesota's iron mining industry in there. I just want to make sure that we're going to include the iron mines and also that we have our steel producers. So if we had like a Cleveland Cliffs or U.S. Steel at the table from their facilities outside of Minnesota, I just want to make sure we have the mines and the actual steel production at the table. Would be my only recommendation to this bill right now, but thanks again for bringing it.
Representative Burke.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So in the DE amendment, I don't know if you guys have this in your packet, but we do list Cleveland Cliffs as one of the players, so to speak, at the table. And so this does, with the DE amendment, include a broader group of supporters. And, well, they're stakeholders. They will be at the table.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Turn it back to the bill author for final comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was super easy. There actually is not a lot left to say. This bill is very unique in the fact that all stakeholders are in agreement. We have had a series of pretty high-level intense meetings to make sure that we are including everybody, that everybody's priorities match the priorities in this bill. As we said, industry is already looking at EPDs and how they can modify what they're doing to reach the environmental standards that we're all hoping for. I think that in this room, we may or may not have different feelings about climate change. So it is really exciting to see so many people that you wouldn't think would agree with this that are on board. So thank you for the opportunity to present this. I look forward to your support.
Thank you, Representative Burke. So with that, the bill is laid over, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.